Coriolanus felt any attempt to dethrone Dr. Gall would be futile, but he adopted a sympathetic manner. "You tried. I failed. I wish my family could just go home, back to District 2 where we belong." "Not that they'd want us," said Sejanus. "Being capital is going to kill me." "It's a bad time, Sejanus. With the games and the bombing, no one is at their best. Don't do anything rash, like running off." As Coriolanus clapped him on the shoulder, he thought, "I might need a favor." "Running off where? How? With what?" said Sejanus. "But I really do appreciate your support. I wish I could think of some way to thank you." There was actually something Coriolanus needed. "You don't happen to have a guitar I could borrow, do you?" The plinths did not, so he devoted the rest of Wednesday afternoon to fulfilling his promise to Lucy Gray. He asked around in school, but the closest thing he got was a maybe from Vipsanius Sickle, mentor of the District 7 boy, Treach, who juggled the walnuts in the zoo.
"Oh, I think we used to have one during the war," she told him. "Let me check and get back to you. I'd love to hear your girl sing again."
He didn't know whether or not to believe her. The Sickles did not impress him as a musical crowd. Vipsania had inherited her Aunt Agrippina's love of competition, and for all he knew, she was trying to spoil Lucy Gray's performance. But two could play at that game. So he told her she was a lifesaver and then continued his search. After coming up empty-handed at the academy, he thought of Pluribus Bell. Possibly he still had instruments lying around from his nightclub days. The minute the door in the back alley opened, Boa Bell wove between Coriolanus' legs, purring like an engine. At 17, she was getting long in the tooth, and he used care as he lifted her into his arms.
"Ah, she's always happy to see an old friend," Pluribus said, and invited Coriolanus in.
The defeat of the districts had made little difference to Pluribus's trade, as he still secured a living dealing in black market goods, even if they now had a more luxurious bent. Decent liquor, makeup, and tobacco were still hard to get hold of. District 1 had slowly turned its attention to supplying the capital with pleasures, but not everyone had access to them, and they came at a high price. The Snows were no longer regular customers, but Tigress made occasional visits to sell him the ration coupons that would allow them to buy meat or coffee, which they usually couldn't afford. People were happy to pay for the privilege of buying an extra leg of lamb. Known for his discretion, Pluribus remained one of the few people Coriolanus didn't need to pretend to be wealthy around. He knew the Snows' situation, but never blabbed about it or made the family feel inferior. Today, he poured Coriolanus a glass of cold tea, filled a plate with cakes, and offered him a chair. They chatted about the bombing and how it brought up bad memories of the war. But soon their talk turned to Lucy Gray, who had made a very favorable impression on Pluribus.
"If I had a few like her, I might think of opening the club back up,"
Pluribus mused.
"Oh, I'd still sell my pretties, but I could stage shows on the weekends. The truth is, we were all so busy killing each other that we forgot how to have fun. She knows, though, your girl."
Coriolanus told him the plan for the interview and asked if there might be a guitar they could borrow. "We'd take good care of it, I promise. I'd keep it at home, except when she's playing, and return it right after the show." Pluribus needed no coaxing.
"You know, I packed everything away after the bombs got Cyrus. Silly, really. As if I could forget the love of my life so easily."
He got to his feet and moved a stack of perfume crates, revealing an old closet door. Inside, lovingly arranged on shelves, was a variety of musical instruments. Pluribus pulled out a surprisingly dust-free leather case and lifted the lid. A pleasant smell of old wood and polish hit Coriolanus' nose as he looked at the gleaming, golden thing inside. The body shaped like a woman's, the six strings running up the long neck to the tuning pegs. He strummed it lightly with his finger. Even though it was badly out of tune, The richness of the sound went right through him. This one's too nice. I wouldn't want to risk damaging it.
I trust you. And I trust your girl. Kind of like to hear what she does with it.
Pluribus closed the case and held it out.
You take it and tell her I've got my fingers crossed for her. It's good to have a friend in the audience.
Coriolanus took the guitar gratefully.
Thank you, Pluribus. I hope you do reopen the club. I'll be a steady customer.
Just like your father, said Pluribus with a chuckle. When he was about your age, he used to close down this place every night with that rascal Casca Highbottom.
Every part of that sounded nonsensical. His stern father, so humorless and strict, living it up in a nightclub, and with, of all people, Dean Highbottom? He'd never heard them mentioned together, although they were about the same age. You're kidding, right?
Oh, no. They were a pair of wild things, said Pluribus.
But before he could elaborate, he was interrupted by a customer. With great care, Coriolanus carried his prize home and laid it on his dresser. Tigris and the Grand Mam oohed and aahed over it, but he couldn't wait to see Lucy Gray's reaction. Whatever instrument she'd had back in District 12 could never compare with Pluribus's. His head ached enough to go to bed at sundown, but it took a while to fall asleep. So preoccupied was he with the relationship between his father and that rascal, Casca Highbottom. If they had been friends, as Pluribus had suggested, none of the goodwill remained. He couldn't help thinking that however close they'd been during their clubbing days, things hadn't ended well. As soon as he could, he'd press Pluribus for more details. The next few days gave him no such opportunity, though, as they were devoted to readying Lucy Gray for the interview, which had been set for Saturday night. Each mentor tribute pair had been assigned a classroom to work in. Two peacekeepers were on guard, but Lucy Gray had been freed of both chains and cuffs. Tigris had provided an old dress of hers, saying that if Lucy Gray was willing to trust her, she could wash and iron her rainbow ruffles for the broadcast. Lucy Gray hesitated, but when he gave her Tigris's other gift, a small cake of soap shaped like a flower and smelling of lavender, she had him turn his back while she changed. The loving way she handled the guitar, as if it were a sentient being, gave him a hint of a past so unlike his own, he had trouble imagining it. She took her time tuning the instrument and then played song after song, seemingly as starved for the music as for the meals he brought. He pumped her with all the food they could spare, along with bottles of tea sweetened with corn syrup to soothe her throat. Her vocal cords were much improved by the time the big night arrived. The Hunger Games, a night of interviews, kicked off in front of a live audience in the Academy Auditorium while broadcasting throughout Pan Am. Hosted by the clownish Capital TV weatherman, Lucretius Lucky Flickerman, it seemed both glaringly inappropriate and surprisingly welcome on the heels of all the killing. Lucky was dressed in a high-collared blue suit with rhinestone accents. His gelled hair was dusted in coppery powder, and his mood could only be described as merry. The back curtain of the stage, resurrected from some pre-war production, depicted a starry sky and twinkled accordingly. After a jaunty rendition of the anthem played, Lucky welcomed the audience to a brand new Hunger Games for a brand new decade, one in which every capital citizen could participate by sponsoring the tribute of their choice. In the chaos of the past few days, the best Dr. Gall's team had been able to do was offer a half dozen basic food items the sponsors could send to the tributes.
"You're wondering, what's in it for you?" chirped Lucky.
Then he explained the gambling, a simple system with win, place, and show options, familiar to those who'd played the ponies before the war. Anyone who wanted to either send a monetary gift to feed a tribute or place a bet on one needed only to visit their local post office, where the staff would be happy to help. Starting tomorrow, they would be open from 8 in the morning until 8 at night, giving people time to place their bets before the Hunger Games kicked off on Monday. After he'd introduced the new wrinkle in the games, Lucky had little to do but read the cue cards with the material that wrapped around the interviews. But he managed to work in a few magic tricks, like pouring different colored wine from the same bottle to toast the Capitol and having a pigeon fly out of his bell-sleeved jacket. Of the mentor-tribute pairs who were capable of participating, only half had something to present. Coriolanus asked to go last, knowing nothing could compete with Lucy Gray but wanting to be the closer for effect. The other mentors offered up background information about their tributes while trying to throw in something memorable and urging the public to sponsor them. To demonstrate his strength, Lysistrata sat primly in her chair while Jessup lifted her over his head easily. Io Jasper's District 3 boy, Cirque, said he could start a fire with his glasses, and she, with her scientific know-how, suggested various angles and times of day that would facilitate the task. Snooty Juno Phipps admitted she'd been disappointed to get Tiny Bobbin. Didn't a Phipps, a member of a founding family of the Capitol, deserve better than District 8? But he'd won her over when he told her five different ways he could kill someone with a sewing needle. Coral, Festus's District 4 girl, made a case for her ability to handle a trident, a weapon that was typically available in the arena. She demonstrated with an old broomstick, wielding it in a sinuous fashion that left little doubt of her expertise. The dairy heiress Demetia Whimsiwick's familiarity with cows turned out to be an asset. Bubbly by nature, she got her muscular District 10 tribute, Tanner, so engaged in talking about slaughterhouse techniques that Lucky had to cut them off when they ran over. Arachne had been wrong about the appeal of that topic, because Tanner garnered the most applause of the evening so far. Coriolanus listened with one ear as he prepared to take the stage with Lucy Gray. Felix Ravenstill, the president's grandnephew, was trying to make an impression with the District 11 girl, Dill, but Coriolanus couldn't figure out his angle, because she'd become so sickly even her coughs were barely audible. Tigris had worked another one of her miracles on Lucy Gray's dress. The filth and soot had vanished, leaving fresh, starchy rows of rainbow ruffles. She'd also sent a pot of blush Fabricia had discarded with just a smidgen left in the bottom. Scrubbed clean with rouged cheeks and lips, her hair piled up on her head as it had been for the reaping, Lucy Gray looked, as Pluribus had said, like someone who still knew how to have fun. "I think your odds get better by the minute," said Coriolanus, adjusting a hot pink rosebud in her hair. It matched the one on his lapel, just in case anyone needed a reminder of who Lucy Gray belonged to. "Well, you know what they say. The show's not over until the Mockingjay sings," she said. "The Mockingjay?" he laughed. "Really, I think you're just making these things up." "Not that one. A Mockingjay's a bona fide bird," she assured him.
"And it sings in your show?" he asked.
"Not my show, sweetheart. Yours. The Capitol's, anyway," said Lucy Gray. "I think we're up."
With her clean dress and his neatly pressed uniform, their very appearance brought a spontaneous round of applause from the audience. He didn't waste time asking her a lot of questions no one cared about. Instead, he introduced himself and stepped back, leaving her alone in the spotlight.
"Good evening," she said. "I'm Lucy Gray Baird, of the Covey Bairds. I started writing this song back in District 12, before I knew what the ending would be. It's my words, set to an old tune. Where I'm from, we call it a ballad. That's a song that tells a story, and I guess this is mine. The Ballad of Lucy Gray Baird. I hope you like it."
Coriolanus had heard her sing dozens of songs over the past few days, full of everything from the beauty of springtime to the heart-wrenching despair of losing her mama. Lullabies and toe-tappers, laments and ditties. She'd solicited his opinion, weighing his responses to each song. He'd thought they'd settled on a charming thing about the wonder of falling in love, but a few bars into this ballad, he knew this was nothing she'd rehearsed. The haunting melody set the tone, and her words did the rest as she began to sing in a voice husky from smoke and sadness.
"When I was a babe,
I fell down in the holler. When I was a girl, I fell into your arms. We fell on hard times, and we lost our bright color. You went to the dogs, and I lived by my charms. I danced for my dinner, spread kisses like honey. You stole and you gambled, and I said you should. We sang for our suppers, we drank up our money. Then one day you left, saying I was no good. Well, all right, I'm bad, but then you're no prize either. All right, I'm bad, but then that's nothing new. You say you won't love me, I won't love you neither. Just let me remind you who I am to you. 'Cause I am the one who looks out when you're leaping. I am the one who knows how you were brave. And I am the one who heard what you said sleeping. I'll take that and more when I go to my grave. It's sooner than later that I'm 6 feet under. It's sooner than later that you'll be alone. So who will you turn to tomorrow, I wonder? For when the bell rings, lover, you're on your own. And I am the one who you let see you weeping. I know the soul that you struggle to save. Too bad I'm the bet that you lost in the reaping. Now what will you do when I go to my grave?
You could hear a pin drop in the auditorium when she finished. Then there were a few sniffles, some coughing, and finally Pluribus's voice shouting out, "Bravo!" from the back of the auditorium, and the thunderous applause that followed. Coriolanus knew it had hit home, this dark, moving, far too personal account of her life. He knew the gifts would pour into the arena for her, that her success, even now, reflected back on him, making it his success. Snow lands on top and all that. He knew he should be elated at this turn of events and jumping up and down inside while presenting a modest, pleased front. But what he really felt was jealous.